Good morning, everyone. We're a few minutes early, but in light of the fact that the attorneys are here and ready to go, I'm going to make a few announcements before we call court to order and call the case. These proceedings are being held via Zoom Gov. I just want to remind you that that means that all rules of appellate procedure except standing is applicable. That also includes no recording. The recording is what we are making of this matter, and no private recordings are permissible. I want you both to pay attention to the time clock. Our marshal has that, in at least in my upper left-hand corner. It should also appear on your screen. Appellant counsel, you'll also have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. I know each of you has been communicating with our court attendant to make sure that systems are working. If for some reason you have a tech issue or a default, you know, wiggle your hands or do something, say something so that it's called to my attention. Now, with that being said, I'm going to ask our marshal to call court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Smith, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding. This is case number A191903, Oliver Wilfred Cass, petitioner respondent versus Yiying Sen, appellant.
And appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, again, please state your name and introduce yourself so we have that as far as our record proceedings.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Graves. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Yiying Sen. We are here this morning to ask the court to reverse and remand a judgment and decree that was entered on October 2nd, 2019, to allow Ms. Sen to be heard on her motion to set aside an oral stipulation that had been entered by the court, or that the parties had entered in July of that year. In reviewing the briefs from both parties, there appears to be an agreement that the standard of review in this case is de novo. The court is being asked to determine whether there has been a violation of my client's due process rights and violations of procedural rules, which require that the de novo review standard be used. Briefly, Your Honors, this is a case that arises, an appeal that arises out of a dissolution case. The parties were married for 9 years. My client, Yiying Sen, had not been employed outside the home during the marriage and in fact had not worked since 2009. During the course of the legal proceedings, concerns were raised about my client's mental capacity and mental health, and a guardian ad litem was appointed to her pursuant to Rule 17.02 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. The parties.
Counsel, can I ask you, because I'm sure we're familiar with the facts, so I want to ask you your argument depends on there being a pending. At the time judgment being entered, that there was a pending motion to challenge a stipulation. Was that what the motion was, or wasn't the motion the actual motion? I know there was some correspondence earlier expressing unhappiness with the settlement, but the motion on its face seemed to be a request to add spousal maintenance, which standing alone wouldn't be a challenge to a stipulation. Otherwise, it just wouldn't be on its face.
Your Honor, Ms. Sen filed the motion, or the original motion was filed pro se. A hearing was scheduled, so there would have been additional pleadings filed had the motion actually been heard in November. But it was, in fact, a motion to set aside the terms of the party's oral stipulation. It was not just to add an award for maintenance. That may have been how, Ms. Sen filed her motion pro se. She was in the process of retaining us. And had we been given the opportunity, an appropriate motion to set aside would have been filed timely if we'd had the opportunity.
How did that timing work relative to when the judgment was entered?
The motion hearing was scheduled for November 6th. The judgment was entered by the court on October 2nd. So it was probably about 2 weeks. Well, I guess that the rules have changed since then. So that was probably about 3 weeks before a motion hearing would have been heard. In fact, what happened is Ms. Sen retained us. And then when I was reviewing NNSIS, I discovered that the divorce decree had been entered. So it was well before our motion would have been due. And in fact, we had asked for a continuance of the hearing because when I came on as counsel, I needed some additional time.
Well, but you came on board and I understand you're arguing procedural due process was denied to wife. I'm gonna refer to her as wife.
That's fine, Your Honor.
This matter, but so I don't know that you've necessarily articulated what life, liberty, or property interest it is that that she was deprived of.
Certainly. Well, Your Honor, it would be the property that was awarded in the divorce decree, the right to request spousal maintenance.
But other than saying I disagree, doesn't there need to be more? Doesn't there need to be an identification of what has she's been deprived of?
Well, she was deprived of her right for an opportunity to be heard, Your Honor. Due process is, you know, obviously there's a liberty right, but there's also a process that she's entitled to. And as we discussed in our brief, that includes the opportunity to be heard, to be represented by counsel, to present evidence, and also requires that she has the right to have a decision made by the trial court that is based on the record before the court. And our argument on the due process is twofold. One, because judgment was entered before she had an opportunity to be heard and present all of her evidence, why she feels the stipulation was entered under duress, the judgment and decree was entered. And as we state in our brief, I'm not going to belabor it, you know, there's a big difference from the burden that we must prove between trying to set aside an oral stipulation and then trying to vacate a judgment and decree under 518.145. And in this case, you know, as we stated in the brief, you know, our arguments will be that Ms. Sen was not given the opportunity to show the her health issues at the time, the fact that she feels that she didn't understand what was going on during when our agreement was read onto the record. If you look at the transcript itself, you can see that as they go through, that Ms. Sen is asking a lot of questions. And I think this is also the part of, you know, and gets to the next part, her attorney never asked her if she felt that the agreement was fair and equitable. Never asked her if she felt there'd been a full disclosure. And that gets to the part of the argument, Your Honor, that an order was entered by the trial court not based solely on the transcript, but upon information that was provided by counsel for Dr. Cass. And that gets to the argument on, you know, that the court entered an order that included in things such as an award of personal property, which was never discussed. There was care and waiver language about the spousal maintenance. And there was some discussion during the argument, during when they put the agreement on the record, about her waiving spousal maintenance, but there was none of the specific language that would normally be needed if you are going to waive spousal maintenance.
On all these issues, I think you chose an appeal as opposed to going forward with a scheduled motion. Could you have given the district court an opportunity to correct what you saw as these errors so that you could apply the stipulation standard instead of the judgment standard and also this topic that you're talking about? And if you could have given the district court that opportunity, did you have to?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we could have, because under the Shirk case, once the decree is entered, the oral stipulation merges into the judgment and decree, and the only motion that we had available to us would have been a motion to vacate, and that is a very different legal standard than I know that counsel for Dr. Cass argued that, well, you could have brought a motion to stay the you could have filed an appeal, brought a motion to stay that, and went back and asked the court to vacate the, or to set aside the stipulation. But again, our reading of the Shirk case, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1997, is that we didn't have the power to do that. And our concern, the reason we filed the appeal, was because we wanted where Ms. Sen was denied her right to do that, to have a motion heard on the stipulation. So, Your Honors, I'm not going to belabor. This is actually a fairly straightforward appeal. There's no question as to the facts. We know that judgment was entered without the requirements of Rule 307B of the Rules of General Practice. We know that the judgment was entered without my client signing off on it, contrary to that law. Counsel for the petitioner, or for the respondent, for husband, has argued that because my client had a guardian ad litem appointed for her, that was sufficient for the court to rely upon in signing the judgment and decree. We've addressed that in our reply brief. It's very clear that a guardian ad litem is not a guardian appointed in a probate matter who has the authority to make binding decisions for the incapacitated person. The guardian in this case, guardian ad litem, was only available to advise the court what she felt was in my client's best interest and could not bind my client. She clearly objected to it. She wouldn't sign off on it, and she was denied her due process when judgment was entered before the court heard her motion to set aside the stipulation. So we're asking the court to grant our motion to reverse the judgment and decree and allow us to and remand the matter to the trial court with instructions to allow my client to bring her motion to set aside the stipulation.
May I ask, counsel, in just looking at your brief, is there any reason, if we were to agree that the timing of it was inappropriate, is there any reason we would, and it's sent back then for a hearing on this to vacate the or void the stipulation, is there any reason that we would reach the issue of whether the decree contains terms that were not part of the settlement placed on the record? I mean, that seems to, well, why would we get to that?
Well, I don't know that you, well, it's a part of the due process argument, Your Honor, because there was information in there that was, you know, there was a decision made that wasn't based on the information before the trial court. For example, the Karen waiver language and the language about that. So again, I think that it would be appropriate for the court to make a finding on that, but it would be as a part of your determination that my client was deprived due process of law.
Because it seems like, let's say it went back and the district court were to decide, oh no, the stipulation is, it was not a subject of duress and et cetera. And, you know, wife understood what was happening. We're still left with the issue of whether it contains terms that were not placed on the record. I'm just trying to figure out at what point that should actually be reviewed.
That's a very good point, Your Honor, because I agree that when it goes back to the trial court, that issue needs to be addressed. There was a proposed judgment and decree that was submitted that contained contained provisions that weren't in the stipulation or in the agreement. And so that would be need to be addressed by the trial court as well.
Okay, thanks.
And I don't have anything further at this time, but I'll save my 5 minutes for rebuttal if I need it.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. We'll turn then to respondent counsel. You're muted, Jet.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Jane Binder, and I represent the respondent, Oliver Cass. Your Honors, appellant argues that her due process rights were violated because the court entered a divorce decree, which was based on an oral stipulation to which she assented without giving her an opportunity to be heard. As the court knows, on July 24th, following 2 days of trial, the parties read an agreement into the record. Appellant was represented by two attorneys at the time and had a guardian ad litem who had been present throughout the entire trial and prior to the trial. And she was present, the guardian, during the negotiations giving rise to the stipulation. Both parties were questioned by counsel in the court. Everybody agreed on the record with some questions. That's not uncommon when agreements are being read into the record. And this was sort of a complicated agreement. And the court ultimately signed the decree.
Well, that right there is the problem, because how do we get around Rule 307B as far as giving time for wife in this case to decide if she wanted to file a motion to set aside?
Well, Your Honor, the decree was submitted, I believe, on August 21, and it was entered on October 2nd or 3rd. And the Rule 307B requirement cited by counsel in appellant's original brief cites an old version of that rule. That rule was amended in 2012, and it changed from requiring a transcript if the decree does not have, quote, written approval of the lawyer for each party, to what it now reads is it needs to be approved by the other party or, quote, their legal representative. And this amendment, I think, is crucial here, because the Supreme Court, in modifying the rule, expanded the definition of who can sign off.
Well, if we agree with that, what authority would the guardian ad litem in this case have had to bind the wife?
Your Honor, she didn't make a decision. She signed it, approving it as to being in consistent with the stipulation that the parties read into the record and as in her client's best interest. And I think for purposes of whether or not respondent was required to submit a transcript to the trial court, her signature satisfies the requirement in Rule 307B.
When was the rule amended?
In 2012.
Okay, so I'm looking at the current rule when I'm looking at it online.
Right.
Which is the written approval of the other party, that's not here, so, or their legal representative. So just to be clear, your argument is that the guardian ad litem was wife's legal representative.
Yes, I think the fact that it does no longer says the party's lawyer and has expanded the definition of people who can sign, it would include a guardian ad litem.
Right. Well, it's expanded it to legal representative. What authority is there that a guardian ad litem is a legal representative?
Well, Your Honor, she was part of this legal proceeding and she was representing Ms. Sen's best interests.
But my concern about that is professional rules of conduct. We would have to fish around and find out who's licensed to practice law and who is engaging in unauthorized practice if we bought that argument.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know about that. I can say that in this case, we had a licensed attorney. And I don't know that that's even required if it's somebody representing some part of a party's interest in the
you're equating a guardian ad litem with a guardian, someone who could actually enter into contracts on behalf of the party or so on, someone who has that authority. And I'm just wondering where you find that authority.
I'm just looking at the clear language of the rule, which was, in my view, expanded to include legal representatives. And I think that would include a guardian ad litem who was charged with assisting the court and advising the court and by signing the stipulation, by signing the decree, I think was acting in that role. I don't think that was giving her the guardian decision-making authority. That was made on the day the agreement was read into the record. In order for the court to find that a party has been deprived of her due process rights, there's a two-pronged test. And the first is, did the government's action deprive the individual of a protected interest? And while I agree with the court's questioning of whether or not a protected interest was deprived, I think the bigger question there is, did the court deprive Ms. Sen of a protected interest? And the answer is no. Appellant never, as the court's pointed out this morning, scheduled a motion to set aside the stipulation. She did file a motion on August 1st, which was scheduled for October 1st, and had she not continued it, would have been heard prior to the court entering judgment.
So what are we to make of the letters, plural, that she attempted to send to the court?
The letters were rejected by the court. She was told, and this is in the record, that they would not be reviewed by the court. And in the Clark case, I believe it is, which is cited in appellant's brief, that party had also sent letters which were considered not a motion. But Ms. Sen had other options if she wanted to make sure that the agreement was set aside. She could have hired an attorney. She had hired four by the time the trial was over. She could have consulted with her guardian ad litem, who could have navigated her through the process and helped her find the resources she needed to create, to bring a motion. She never did anything to notify the court that she wanted this stipulation set aside. And yet she says the court deprived her of her due process rights by not giving her an opportunity to be heard. The court, she did schedule a motion. I mean, and she filed papers that said she wanted more spousal maintenance. I agree, that's not a formal motion to set aside a stipulation. But even having scheduled a motion or filed a paper doesn't constitute some giving the court notice that she's challenging the stipulation. The court, judges don't review pleadings when they're filed to see what's going on. We don't even know that the court knew she had a motion pending when it signed the decree. And we don't know that the court, we certainly can't imagine that the court knew what was in the motion. She could have brought a motion for any number of things at that time. So before the decree was entered, she did not take advantage of the opportunity to challenge the stipulation. Now, the court entered the judgment on October 2nd or 3rd, and she still had a motion pending, but she kept continuing it. It was originally scheduled not for November 6th, as counsel said, but October 1st. It was continued to November 6th, then it was continued to December 19th, and then it was canceled because of this appeal.
Well, but that's information that's outside of our record. We can't take that into consideration.
Well, it was canceled. I think the minces would show that it was never held. But appellant could have, after the decree was entered, she could have gone forward with her motion, and she could have asked the court to consider it a motion to set aside the stipulation, even with the Shirk case, as was questioned before. Because in this case, if the trial court would consider her motion, the one she filed, one to reopen the stipulation, it was pending before the decree was entered. In Shirk, there was no motion before the decree was entered. In the cases that cite Shirk, there was no motion pending before the decree was entered. So the rule that once a decree is entered, the only way to get out of a decree is under 518.145, could reasonably be challenged to include setting aside a stipulation if the motion was properly brought before the decree was entered, which I'm not sure it was properly brought, but it certainly was an argument that counsel and Ms. Sen could have made. And again, if she was worried about losing her right to appeal, she could have filed the appeal and asked that it be set aside. We tried to encourage that in the course of the briefing schedule, and that was not take, the appellant did not avail herself of that, and the court did not agree with us. But I think still that is an option that she had. And again, she was not deprived of due process by the government. The government did nothing but follow the procedures set forth for the signing of this stipulation, for the entry of this stipulation. And after the decree was entered, she still had resources and processes available to her. So under the second prong of the due process test, were the procedures followed constitutionally sufficient? Well, there were constitutionally sufficient processes available to the appellant, to which she did not avail herself. That is not a denial of due process. And this decree should not be overturned. Appellant cites terms that were in the decree that she claims were not part of the oral stipulation. And she cites these provisions not really because they're of concern, but to make the point that this is somehow a deprivation of due process because terms were included. The reality is, when parties read an agreement into the record and attorneys read an agreement into the record, they address the most controversial and substantive terms. Then the lawyers go back to their office and write up the agreement. And the things that they're claiming were added are really boilerplate terms. First of all, there was no Karen waiver here. Karen waivers are to modify spousal maintenance. This was a waiver of maintenance. And so there's not these additional terms that weren't part of the agreement. We were in trial for 2 days. And of course, there was a full disclosure of each party's financial circumstances. The court announced from the bench that he thought the terms, I don't think he used the words fair and equitable, but he said this was a good agreement for both parties. These are not additions made by respondent or his counsel to muck up this agreement. It's just, this is part of what goes into a decree. Each party gets their personal property. They waive their rights to other claims against each other, etc. Counsel in her brief cites cases, in particular this Ertl case, E-R-T-L, that courts cannot impose conditions on parties to which they didn't stipulate. Well, in Ertl, the court imposed a $20,000 obligation on somebody. This is not that. This is really a red herring to try to get this decree reversed and remanded. Your Honors, everything was done properly in this case. All the rules were followed, and the parties worked hard on this agreement. There's no basis to overturn it and send this back to the trial court. These parties should be done with their litigation. And I ask that you affirm the judgment and decree and deny the request of the appellant.
Thank you, Ms. Binder. Ms. Graves, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just try to highlight a couple of brief points. First, Ms. Binder acknowledges in her argument that my client was required to sign the judgment and decree or a legal representative on her behalf to sign it per Rule 307B. She cites no authority for a guardian ad litem to have that authority. In fact, the appointment order for the guardian ad litem in this case and Ramsey County's own guidelines for guardians specifically state that a guardian ad litem does not have the authority to make binding decisions for a party. No one signed that judgment and decree on behalf of Ms. Sen. So it was improperly entered. As far as the argument that because there was a motion pending, that this was sufficient for her due process rights, what's missing are key parts of that due process, which is a right to have a hearing and a right to have to make the argument. And none of that was afforded to Ms. Sen. The order was entered without her, and again, she didn't even know that it had been entered because she had not been receiving proper notice. The argument that Ms. Binder makes that the fact that my client could have brought a motion to vacate after the judgment and decree was entered is constitutionally sufficient. We've addressed that in our brief. It's clearly not correct. The Shirk case does not allow us to go back and make arguments that would have been available to my client had it just been based, had the motion been based on the stipulation. And then I guess the final thing I wanted to point out, the additional language to the judgment and decree that was added, which was, you know, admittedly not in the party's oral agreement, went beyond just boilerplate language. This couple had two houses full of furnishings, three houses, and none of that is addressed in the oral stipulation. And so for it to just be included in the judgment and decree without my client's input, deprive her of her due process rights. So we are asking the court to reverse vacate the judgment and decree and allow us to bring a motion to set aside the stipulation to the trial court. Thank you.
Can I ask? Go
ahead, Judge Smith, if you have a question.
So is it your suggestion that there should be for example, the district court finds, no, the stipulation was not under duress or it was not, you know, that was knowingly voluntarily entered into, et cetera. The property, are you suggesting that should go to then a trial on the property issue because it wasn't included? I mean, if the district court finds that the rest of it is fine, in other words, and that is just an extra provision, what are you asking?
Well, we would ask that my client have, you're correct, Your Honor, it would be a trial, or at least my client would have the ability to present some evidence on how she believes that those assets should be divided, because it was not addressed in their agreement, and it was never addressed by the trial court.
Thank
but
you.
It might be if it's in the stipulation.
That was a statement. Correct, Your Honor. Okay. But it wasn't. It was not included. So my client did not have the opportunity to address that. So thank you. And again, we're asking the court to reverse and remand this matter to the trial court.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Graves, as well as Ms. Binder. The matters were well briefed and the arguments are very helpful to us today. A decision, so the parties, I understand, are also listening. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe, which is going to be 90 days. Now, with that said, I am inquiring, and this is not a part of our decision. I'm following up on our own Court of Appeals process. Did the parties proceed to mediation via the Court of Appeals before coming for argument?
We did, Your Honor.
Okay, that was just a question I had. And again, I'm only saying that because if in fact this follows the path that may in fact occur, there seems to be lots of opportunity for the parties yet to attempt to resolve their differences with counsel that's obviously seasoned attorneys in terms of the law of family matters. So I will stop talking with that said. And at this point, we will stand in recess to discuss our remaining cases that are non-oral.